broadcasting just for you from Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Abiyaz Karim, and Jaya Kumar. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, Wattle Eyewear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. In the wake of the coldest months of the year, Homebase Housing has added an additional 10 beds to their In From the Cold emergency shelter. Homebase Housing is a nonprofit organization offering a variety of services, including emergency shelters, transitional housing, and supportive housing. The In From the Cold emergency shelter operates 24/7, 365 days a year, providing a range of supports, including not only a bed to sleep in at night, but also a dedicated case manager to help individuals secure permanent housing. In 2024, In From the Cold housed 64 individuals, moving them from the shelter into housing of their own. In spite of limited resources, Homebase Housing was able to stretch their current means to expand from 24 to 34 beds. This marks a return to the shelter's pre-COVID capacity. This move comes at a crucial time, with temperatures dropping and the homelessness crisis reaching a tipping point, according to the Association of Municipalities of Ontario. A study released last week by the association reported over 80,000 Ontarians were known to be homeless in 2024, an increase of more than 25% since 2022. Municipalities and local organizations have been bearing the brunt of this burden, with municipal contributions making up over half of the funding for housing and homelessness programs across all three levels of government. Amanda Brierly, manager of shelter services with Homebase Housing, spoke with CFRC on the expansion of the shelter and the increasing demand for services. You were able to add 10 new beds to the Kingston Homebase Shelter. How was Homebase Housing able to make this possible? What's the story there?
Yeah. So there's a lot of mixed messages back and forth in media and things like that. So just to clear it up and what we've done. So In From the Cold was at 24 beds. We opened 10 new beds, bringing our total to 34 individuals. Pre-COVID, In From the Cold was at 34 individuals. So people are like, no big deal, you were there before. It is a big deal because since COVID, we have a lot more guidelines and restrictions through public health that we need to follow in an infectious disease protocols. And we didn't have those before. And so now we have those to adhere to. And so we're putting more people into a smaller space that then creates more bacteria, more viruses, more things like that. And so it is a big step for us to move up to 34 from 24 individuals. We know the need is out there. We see the need in the community through our street outreach program. And so it was something we were able to do because we did have those beds before. And so it was something we were able to do to try to help fill that need for our community. 10 was the max we could do because that's what we were at before. And like I said, we're just putting more people into a smaller space, which isn't good for anybody. So we feel like we are at our max, but that it is manageable at this point.
Absolutely. And was it additional funds that came in that kind of allowed you to take that step and add those beds back, or how were you able to do that?
There are no additional funds. So Homebase Housing is a nonprofit agency, and so we do rely a lot on private donors, grants, and funding that we apply for. These 34 additional beds, we are doing on our own at this point, in hopes of helping alleviate some of those or help alleviate, not having places to go for the unhoused population.
You alluded to this. It's not as simple as just, well, 10 more people can come in, we're adding 10 more beds. What are those resources, both in terms of, you mentioned you didn't get additional funding for this, but what are those resources that needed to be added in order to accommodate 10 extra people?
Yeah, so, bedding, laundry, food, hygiene, all of that has increased, right? Your basic needs. So, food was our number one. We've seen, that Our fridge has looked more bare than it ever has in the last 4 years. But we are fortunate with community partners. Queen Soul Food helps us out, as well as food rescues through the Second Harvest food program. So we're very fortunate that way. But we still do have a need for food. We're feeding 34 individuals 3 times a day, and we're not receiving additional funding, right? So food is a big resource, as well as just hygiene, you know, making sure that we have shampoos, conditioners, soaps, socks, underwear, all of those basic necessities for people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did you work with public health in order to add these extra 10 beds as well?
So we've talked about, you know, infectious control, and, you know, where we need to be disinfecting or where we can, you know, put up some barriers in between bunk beds and things like that to help prevent any spread. We've talked about cohorting and how we can work when we do have somebody that's unwell in such a small confined area with so many individuals, because we're unable to isolate people. So that's the other thing people don't realize is we don't have isolation. Everybody's sleeping in one large room together. And so again, you know, that creates some unsafe situations when we're talking about public health and new infectious diseases. And so just trying to mitigate some of those risks by cohorting people with symptoms and things like that. So that's what we've had to do. It's like I said, it's not been easy, but it's manageable.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah. And like you said, it hasn't been easy, but clearly there's a need. I was wondering if you could speak to the importance of giving this extra support, especially during the winter months.
Absolutely. So we know in the city of Kingston, we have an unhoused population. We see every walk of life come through our doors. Homelessness doesn't happen to just one individual. Our street outreach team is seeing individuals, you know, on the streets, and the need is there. The importance comes from that. It comes from what we're seeing. It's not coming from numbers. It's not coming, you know, from media outlets. It's coming from the direct interactions that our street outreach team is having with individuals on the street. We do know that the ICH used to function at a very much different way previous to September. And now since they've reopened, their space has minimized a bit as well. And so we knew that was happening. So if we were able to help with that need, as well as the closure of 218 Concession Street Warming Center, right? So we knew that was happening. So we knew that there would be a need. So as I said, we saw the need there, and it was how can we help fill that need? And this is what we were able to do.
Once again, that was Amanda Brierly with Homebase Housing on the recent expansion of the In From the Cold Emergency Shelter. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jaya and Abiyaz with Campus Corner, the latest in Queen's campus news.
Hey there, listeners. We have Ms. Linda Henderson with us. She is the Employee Wellness Engagement Coordinator within the Employee Wellness Services in Queen's University, and they have been doing some amazing work. They have an upcoming seminar regarding eating plan for stress management, and we will be talking about. Hello, Ms. Henderson. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, and thank you so much for inviting me to speak to you about our upcoming seminar.
It was our pleasure. So, Ms. Henderson, let's get right to the seminar. What inspired you and the Wellness Center to organize this seminar for us?
So at Queen's University, fostering a culture of wellness is a strategic priority, and this seminar aligns with our intentional data-driven approach to wellness planning. January is an ideal time to focus on nutrition and well-being, as many individuals are setting New Year's resolutions, participating in things like Dry January, or revisiting fitness goals. This session was designed to meet a critical need by providing evidence-based practical tools and managing stress effectively. So stress is very common within the workplace, and at Queen's, mental health accounts for 37% of the medical leave claims, while personal and workplace stress are the leading reasons employees seek assistance through our family and assistance program. So chronic stress is also a significant contributor to the conditions like diabetes, with related prescription claims increasing by 37% from 2022 to 2023. So we felt that nutrition plays a critical role in mitigating the effects of stress and supporting the overall resilience. So during this 1 hour session that we'll be offering, participants will learn how to specific foods can enhance energy levels, boost immune defenses, improve mental clarity. We'll be, you know, offering measures to be able to help with dietary habits and being able to, empower participants to take proactive steps toward managing stress and fostering sustainable habits. So we felt this was a really good opportunity to be able to do that.
That actually sounds like a really good initiative. So you have mentioned that the seminar is mainly focused towards faculty and staff, but I know for a fact that students also undergo a lot of stress, be it academic stress or stress related to their professional work. So can students also participate in this seminar?
They can, although we generally have a focus for staff and faculty, but if they'd like to be part of it, it's just a matter of registering for the course, yes.
Right. So about that, can you talk about the registration deadline and what prerequisites our audience should have before signing up for this seminar?
For sure. So we really have no complete deadline as far as when people can sign up. They could sign up to and including the time of the seminar. So the seminar is taking place on January the 16th. From 12 until 1, and registration for that is done through our learning stream, and it's open to faculty and staff. And if students want to do that as well, you can go to the Queen's Human Resources main webpage, and we have a wellness tab there, and then under that wellness tab there's a Thrive 365 tab, and you can do the registration through there. It's free, and the person that will be actually doing the session for us is a registered dietitian through our Employee Family and Assistance Program, and her name is Leah Shanehouse, and she's one of the facilitators that TELUS uses.
Great. Can you talk a bit about her background, her credentials, please?
And as I said, she's a registered dietitian with the College of Dietitians of Ontario and British Columbia, and she's also a member of the Dietitians of Canada. So she graduated with a degree in Nutritional Sciences, Bachelor of Science, from the University of British Columbia, and then she went on to do her Master's degree in Human Nutrition at McGill. So I think she'll be a great resource for us to be able to learn more about, you know, how we react within an environment when we are stressed and how eating will either help us or not help us in that.
Wow, she seems really experienced. So will there be opportunities for the audience to interact with Ms. Leah?
Yeah, absolutely. When we set up the seminar, we asked her what the format she would like to use, and she said, you want to have question and answer throughout. So yes, the chat will be a feature where people can do the questions and answers. As well, I think if there are things after the seminar is over, we'll have the opportunity to be able to have those questions sent to her, and she can provide us answers as well.
That sounds great. Thank you, Ms. Henderson, for making the time for us today and talking about this seminar. And that's a wrap for this segment of Campus Corner. I'm Abiyaz Antarib Karim for CFRC News.
Hello, everyone. This is Isabella Garrido, your CFRC sports reporter, coming to you from the CFRC sports desk with the latest updates from Queen's University Athletics. Let's dive right in. First up, the 2025 Carr-Harris Challenge Cup is just around the corner. The Queen's Gaels and RMC Paladins will reunite hockey's oldest rivalry in the 37th Carr-Harris Challenge Cup on Thursday, February 6th at 7:30 p.m. This exciting matchup will take place at Slush Puppy Place. Tickets are now available online or in person at the Slush Puppy Place and Queen's Athletics and Recreation Center. Prices for the general public are $15, and Queen's students, don't forget, 500 free tickets are available at the ARC's Q service desk. Just bring your student ID to claim your ticket or purchase additional ones for $5 each. Dating back to 1886, this historic rivalry is the longest on record. The winner will take home the Carr Harris Trophy, which features the Lenny sculpture, commemorating the first game between RMC and Queens. It's a must-see event for any hockey fan. Switching over to basketball, the Queens Gales women's basketball team is hosting their annual Shoot for the Cure game on Saturday, January 25th at 4 p.m., also at the Arc. This initiative, led by U Sports Women's Basketball Coaches Association, raises funds and awareness for the Canadian Cancer Society in support for breast cancer research. This event is especially meaningful for us Gales as they rally together for those affected by cancer. Fans are encouraged to wear pink and cheer on the Gales as they take on the Brock Badgers. Currently tied up for first in the OUA Central Division standings with an 8-4 record, the Gales are holding strong in third place at the OUA East with a 10-2 record. Tickets for this important game can be purchased on the Queens Gales Tickets website. Don't miss the chance to support a great cause while enjoying some exciting basketball action. And lastly, some quick updates. Queens men's basketball team is now ranked 8th in the OUA, continuing to show their strength this season. For tickets to see these and upcoming games, head over to gales.universitytickets.com. That's all for today from the CFRC Sports Desk. This has been Isabella Garrido bringing you the latest from Queen's University Athletics. Now back to Christina Laurie for your evening weather report.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, January 15th, we are going to see a beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston, but it still will be quite chilly with a daytime high of minus 5, dropping to minus 13 overnight. Thursday, January 16th, daytime high of minus 3 with a 40% chance of flurries throughout the day, dropping down to minus 6 overnight. Friday, January 17th, slightly warmer at minus 2 and cloudy, only dropping down a single degree to minus 3 overnight. Saturday, January 18th, we're going to see a daytime high of 2 degrees, but there is a 60% chance of precipitation, a mix of flurries and rain showers, dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Sunday, January 19th, we will see a daytime high of minus 5 with a mix of sun and cloud. And as we move into the start of next week, temperatures are going to drop again. Monday, January 20th, we'll see a daytime high of minus 9, dropping to minus 16 overnight. And Tuesday, January 21st, it'll be cloudy with a daytime high of minus 11 and an overnight low of minus 17. This is Jesse Bell with your traffic report for the City of Kingston. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Charles Street, Bagot to Rideau is closed beginning January 13th at 7 a.m. to January 14th at 7 p.m. for the installation of a new gas service. Earl Street, Aberdeen to Division is closed until January 17th to support construction-related activity. University Avenue, Union to Stewart is closed January 13th to 14th for a crane lift on University Avenue. Wellington Street, Earl to Gore is closed January 13th to 18th to accommodate service tie-ins. Here are some other delays you should be aware of. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl. Expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles / Edwin to Princess. Expect delays while a contractor completes phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. And lastly, Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard at Elmwood. Expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by the Sugar Pills called Sugar Pill. The latest track gives listeners a window into a night out in Kingston with the band. It speaks to making your own fun regardless of time or place. Sugar Pill has that quintessential feel-good factor, leaving you with an optimistic glow. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Sugar Pill by the Sugar Pills on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Liam's at the bar stealing coasters. Isaiah's outside admiring our poster. Evan's waiting on a drink he ordered 20 minutes ago. An old guy just offered me a beer, but I know if I take it, I'll have to stay here. And all of this has got me wondering if I should have gone home when Caleb did. But now it's 2 a.m. and so I'll offer them a handful of sugar pills. I'll take one if you will.
What you listening to, son?
I don't think you like it.
Well, why not? I like this new generation of music. What the? Where did you record this?
See, that's the type of...
It just makes me want to... That's my boy! Yeah!
Things I Will Keep, Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m. on 101.9 FM. Things that
I will keep. I have been advised to listen to this record.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by Nolan Hubbard and Sit Still called Pollen. Pollen is about embracing growth and confidently moving on from the things holding you back. Sonically, it unfolds gradually. Bouncy bass lines, lush vocal harmonies, swirling indie rock guitars, and dynamic production works together that bring the track into full bloom. Hubbard's distinctively stylish vocals, paired with Sit Still's rhythmic prowess, create a vibrant musical collaboration. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Pollen by Nolan Hubbard and Sit Still on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Keep inhaling all the pollen. I don't need you in my garden. Behaving, stop installing. Don't be hating, I'm not calling.
Didn't think I'd make the cut. See me now, things looking up. Used to be so in a rush. I was stressing out, I was losing touch. Used to think I'd never see this person I turn out to be. But now I've got this energy. So keep your shade away from me. Thought that we'd grow into something beautiful, but it wasn't mine to hold. No, the water doesn't flow.
Keep inhaling all the pollen. I don't need you in my garden.
You got caught creeping through the weeds. Get caught while some of the seeds.
Misbehaving, stop installing. Don't be hating, I'm not calling.
Don't tell me I'll steal my cup. When I'm dreaming, don't wake me up.
Say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
Join us every Thursday at 1 on CFRC for your special time with your favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this is Ella.
And you're listening to the only show.
Beat banter.
On CFRC Radio.
Beat.
Banter.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus community radio station, broadcasting to you since 1922.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Kerutas Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Kojiko Cable, channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca. Welcome to Biotech Bit. This is your host, Chris Rao. Today we will hear from Dr. Hagen on the topic, how diet can affect health and longevity. This program was produced and distributed by the Linus Pauling Institute. Before that, a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and on Twitter at CFRC.
But hello and welcome to the Linus Pauling Institute webinar series. This is our next webinar in our 21st anniversary series, and this is Keeping Life in Your Years, Dietary Factors Affecting Health Span and Longevity with our own Dr. Tori Hagen.
First of all, thank you very kindly for that introduction, as well as this opportunity to come together today and talk to you all about an issue in an area that's near and dear to my research heart, and that is factors affecting health span and longevity, and perhaps how diet can strongly influence our overall health, even into advanced age. As an outline for today's talk, I think what we should start with is some definitions of what biological aging is, and then introduce a concept of what health span is and give definitions of that, and then move toward factors that affect healthy aging, which we can modify. And one of the biggest modifiers that I know of is how diet can play a positive role in our overall health, especially in older adults. We're going to look at possibly effects of food quantity versus food quality. And then if time permits, we'll touch on newer bioactive compounds that are being researched that may be able to improve and maintain health insurance for as long as possible in our lives. So to begin, we're interested in my laboratory under the underlying mechanisms of advanced aging, how younger adults are basically turned over time and at a rate of time dependent on the species into an older animal, in this case an older human. We want to understand those underlying biological factors that influence this overall process. Now, our work on the biological aspects of aging is kind of separate from other fields of research, such as psychosocial work on aging, which have very different kinds of definitions and outcomes than we have. To distinguish biological aging, our field tends to call it senescence. And the definition of senescence is illustrated on the screen right here. It is a natural process of our metabolism, which obviously is comprised of information directed from genes. So it's a normal part of our biology. Aging is a progressive and irreversible process. It starts early on in adult life and progresses from there. And unfortunately, there is no going back in biological senescence. So there's a rate of aging dependent on the species, and that rate of aging is considered to be a senescence rate of aging, because senescence in its very endpoint is a rather deleterious process. No one single aspect is deleterious, but in aggregate it is. And ultimately, aging increases the risk of pathologies, morbidities, and a failure to thrive, ultimately leading to the death of the individual, and obviously, at a rate of aging, the death of a cohort of a species, which sets the longevity or the lifespan of a species. How important is biological senescence in our overall rate or trajectory of long life? It is really impressively important, especially after adulthood. If we took a magic wand and magically stopped senescence, where mortality could only be from pressures of survival from outside our body, such as disease or accidents or temperature extremes or famine and the like, and we looked at a cohort of individuals over time, we would see a survival curve akin to what I'm showing you here on this slide, where you would start out at a certain level, practically everyone surviving immediately, but then there would be a rate of loss of life of that cohort or that group of individuals being examined all the way until the end, where there is no one left in that cohort. If we looked at that and actually looked at the longevity of this group, we would find that greater than 95% of us would reach 100 years of age, and 50% of us, or the mean or average lifespan, would be around 1,200 years of age. So I don't think that any of us in our own lives have actually been around someone that old. And that does tell you then that the pressures from within, our own biological makeup, really are the means by which drives overall longevity, especially in advanced cultures or the developed world. What we actually see in terms of survival curves here, let's say in the developed world, is something more like this, where, again, young adults, there are a very limited number of loss of life in young adulthood, again, from pressures normally from outside the body, where 12 to 15-year-olds in this country have a 1 in 2,000 chance of dying at any given time. But after about what we're considering middle age, around the mid-30s, you start seeing more and more loss of life, and that is at a consistent rate, all the way down until there's an asymptote and finally the end of life of a given group. This sets our mean lifespan or average lifespan, which is what we normally talk about in everyday circumstances. And in America, that is right now at about 79 years of age on 2021 estimates. This also sets the maximum lifespan of a species. Basically, it's the time when the last member of a group survives, and our maximum lifespan right now is 122 years and 5 months, which was set by a lovely lady named Jean Calment, who died in the 1990s at this very, very advanced age. So this is what we normally see. And you can see then, as we go further, that what's happening here is this rate of aging, where then at the end of life, let's say 100 years of age, you have a 1 in 2 chance of dying. The pressures of survival, especially after middle age, are becoming more and more related to your biological or senescence aspects of metabolism, versus those pressures from without, which are kind of set more earlier in life at a rate of mortality. So what happens then is that the physiological function correlates with that rate of senescence. On this graphic I'm showing you are changes in various physiological aspects of life. And as you can see here, there are two things to take away from this slide. One is that your physiology just doesn't deteriorate at one moment or on a given set of anatomical and physiological functions, they don't deteriorate at a given rate either, but rather different rates depending on what you're talking about in terms of your physiology. Mostly, though, you don't see changes in physiological function until around middle age. That's the other aspect to take away from this. And then you see a progressive decline in overall physiological function, regardless of what your type of physiology you're talking about. For instance, cardiac reserve declines right about middle age and at a rate thereafter. So does lung capacity. That's why you don't normally see elite athletes after, let's say, middle age, because at the top of their game anyway, because of the changes in the physiological pressures that are occurring because of senescence. But you see other aspects of your physiology kind of declining relatively early, such as eyesight accommodation can occur even in your 20s or before, and as well as kidney function and blood flow there can start at a small changes even early in life. And so aging and senescence is not a one-size-fits-all. You don't wake up one moment and are old. It is a progressive change, and it's a change in aggregate that ultimately leads to a failure to thrive. Now, none of these changes that I'm showing you here on this graph actually do lead to those pressures of survival. What we're looking at here in the normal physiology of a given species is a change or a decrement that sets up risks for disease. And that's really what is driving the loss of life and the loss of health into advanced age. And that is seen more on this slide right here, where this is a kind of look at the prevalence of many chronic diseases of aging, with broken down into age groups. And as you can see on the early part of this graph near the origin, there is not a lot of chronic diseases in prevalence. You know, you can see some, but not very much. But really, again, right when those physiological deterioration starts becoming an aggregate, you start seeing a rise in the incidence of chronic disease is almost across the board, such as that cancers, which is this green line, increase with the fourth power of age. Heart disease and arthritis, which is kind of a disuse syndrome for pain, also increases rather dramatically right around your 30s and all like that. So this tells you something. All of this says that age itself is the leading risk factor for many of the prevalent chronic diseases that afflict our society today. Only asthma does not have an aging component. And so, in other words, the physiological changes brought about by the senescence process is also the driver of diseases that occur in advanced middle age and later on in life, which ultimately leads to a failure to thrive. This also tells you something else. If you take those two figures in aggregate, it says that our lifespan, which we showed was about 79 years of age, is not keeping pace with health or our health span. Health span is defined as the time of one's life spent free from disease and disuse. And what we mean by disuse is syndromes of pain, like I showed you about arthritis or mobility issues, frailty, and the like. So health span is not the same as lifespan. And what we're seeing here in the United States is actually been codified by the World Health Organization in their Healthy Average Life Expectancy Scale, where again, our lifespan on average is around 79 years of age, but our health span in America is clocked in only at 64 years of age, which means this is when we are starting to see diseases and maybe multiple diseases prevalent in a person. So if we take these two numbers together, we basically are showing that 20% of our lives are lived with some form of disease or inability to carry out daily activities of living that we would normally do in a younger lifetime. This is telling us a big, big thing. This tells us that health span and lifespan don't meet up, and that we are, our last years of life are not necessarily healthy years where we can really do what we want. So at the Lyons Pauling Institute, we're asking a question. Is there a way to bridge the gap between lifespan and health span? In fact, this is what drives many of the researchers here in this institute and what we can do about this big gap. Can we actually compress morbidities where then health and life more or less match up, and a long period of life too? So what we have identified, though, there are five factors that really strongly influence health span in America today. And fortunately, and we're going to look at this later, these are modifiable factors as opposed to other senescence factors that we may not be able to modify as much. These five factors I list right here. One is a sedentary lifestyle, which leads to enhanced frailty and disuse syndromes. It can also perhaps drive other of these risk factors like obesity and diabetes. Hypertension is another one. Hypertension is known as a silent killer. It's a real risk factor for stroke, but also is known to increase the chances for kidney failure as well as other cardiovascular diseases. We talked about obesity already in terms of sedentary lifestyle, but a gain of weight or a weight above a body mass index of 25 leads to increased risk for the so-called metabolic syndromes of insulin resistance, changes in inflammation and chronic inflammation, which also leads to cardiovascular diseases. But obesity is also increasingly correlated with dementia as well as cancers later in life, especially like breast cancer and colon cancer. So obesity is a really driver of those chronic age-related diseases that we talked about earlier. Diabetes is another one. We all know about that. It's a real risk factor for cardiovascular diseases, for neurocognitive dysfunction, as well as polyneuropathies and pain. And finally, smoking is a huge factor, major risk factor for the loss of health, especially later in life. And we're certainly advocating no smoking if you can possibly avoid it. Don't start, and definitely stop if you are smoking, because smoking is a huge risk factor for cancers, cardiovascular diseases, and the like. So these are the big five, as I call them, big five risk factors that really drive those chronic diseases and drive the loss of health, especially in later in life. How important are these risk factors? Well, I think it is very well illustrated in this slide right here. This was a research done by Yates et al., and they were asking a question. Of those folks, let's say 70-year-old men, which is near the mean lifespan of the United States population, what is the probability of those 70-year-olds to survive well into advanced old age with any one or more of these risk factors? In other words, do you have the probability to live an additional 20 years if you had any of these risk factors that we went over? Well, they looked at epidemiological evidence and longitudinal data and showed that if you had none of those risk factors at the age of 70, you had a remarkably good chance for living 20 additional years and living well, to be very honest with you. However, if you had any one of those risk factors, your probability of living another 20 years was virtually cut in half. And if you had more than one, as is shown down here on this scale, portion of this scale, you had an increasingly less likelihood of surviving an additional 20 years. That really tells you that those risk factors that we just went over are extraordinarily powerful about limiting health and, frankly, then limiting life because of them. The good news is that all of those factors, at least, are modifiable. They can be modified in what we're calling also the three-legged stool of longevity and health. And that is, one, around your own personal genetic makeup and epigenetic makeup, where, again, folks that are from long-lived families tend to have a 15 to 25% longevity quotient, which seems to be a means by which you can resist the development of those chronic diseases and may even have some resistance even if you are involved with those risk factors that we had. But that is a very small dividend. So your genetics are not your destiny. In fact, the bigger effects that you can modify those risk factors come from lifestyle choices. So our friends in the psychosocial fields of aging tell us that if we have a good social network as we get older, or a belief system, we tend to live longer and healthier. We also know more on a physiological basis. Again, if you're a couch potato, that's not a good thing. That's one of those risk factors. So that means if you were to be exercising and active, that would be very helpful, and that's a lifestyle choice. Dr. Magnuson went over in her seminar a few weeks ago that if you exercise your brain by keeping fit and changing up your overall kind of processes and learning, you will do better as you get older, and that will improve your health. The thing that I want to dwell on today, though, is that diet is a major means of modifying those big five risk factors and a major means of improving both health span and possibly even lifespan. That's something that is still being looked at here. So healthy eating matters, and it is by far the biggest means by which we can modify risk for health, especially in old age. How important is diet in terms of healthy aging? Well, I think it can be well illustrated by talking just briefly about a paradigm of diet called dietary restriction. Dietary restriction is a means by which you basically restrict the amount of caloric intake while still maintaining all of the vitamins, minerals, and micronutrients that are necessary for normal metabolism. This has been done since the 1930s on experimental animal models of aging, such as yeast, Drosophila, mice, and now even primates, where if you restrict the amount of calories, you actually change the survival curves of a given group of those species. So if we're looking at, let's say, mice here on this curve, the survival curve, this is the ad libitum curve. These mice could eat anything they wanted, and on average, this red dashed line tells you that they lived about 30 months of age, and their maximum lifespan was about 3 years. This is what we know, and we can have in mice in a vivarium in an institute like the Linus Pauling Institute that is very pristinely maintained. So what happens, though, if we restrict the calories in mouse cohorts? Well, we find that with a 25% dietary restriction, look at this. These mice, on average, live longer. And if we restrict even further, like to 55% or 65%, you get a huge dividend in the average lifespan. You've almost doubled it, all the way up to 50 months of age. And look at this. With any type of dietary restriction, you've also changed the maximum lifespan of those groups. That tells us that you have actually modified the rate of aging. This is the only known paradigm. And so diet can modify the rate of aging in this type of experimental plan. Does that mean that these mice are living longer but not well? Well, I think a picture is worth a thousand words. Here is a dietary restricted old mouse on the left-hand side. Here is an ad libitum fed old mouse, meaning that they're the same age. One is just dietary restricted versus the other. You can actually see a huge difference, can't you? The one that was fed whatever the animal wanted, he is really moribund, doesn't move around a lot, very likely has cancer and the like, probably has learning and memory impairments and various factors of aging. Whereas the dietary restricted mouse has a very youthful appearance, is very active, and very limited levels of chronic diseases. So health span is directly modified to the positive, meaning that caloric restriction improves health and it improves lifespan. So that is the power, that's the gold standard power of diet in terms of longevity and healthy aging. Now, can we do this type of paradigm? It would be very, very difficult for humans to restrict their calories to the extent that we can do this in an experimental conditions like here at the LPI. However, we can kind of take this as an issue and use this to say, what can we do in our own lives to maybe get some of the good as we're seeing here in this experimental feeding paradigm. And the easiest one, and the one that I'd like to leave with as a first kind of means by which our recommendations are coming from our group, is that avoid overeating. You may not be able to live that Spartan existence of cutting down your calories to the extent that we can in a vivarium to a living cohort, but you can avoid overeating. And you can avoid overeating, which is, again, hard to do, but you can really work on that. So avoid energy-dense foods or highly processed foods and foods with refined sugars and all, because overeating is a major risk factor for obesity, which also leads to diabetes and hypertension, and actually may even contribute to the sedentary lifestyle. We've talked about this already to some degree. I'll just mention again, obesity because of overeating can catalyze a number of health-associated problems that we're working on here at the Linus Pauling Institute, I'll tell you. But just to kind of name a few again, cognitive decline, fatty liver disease, with Dr. Jump is working on this, brittle bones, especially for osteoporosis, and chronic inflammation too. So overeating leads to a lot of problems, in other words, and we can't avoid that. What about other aspects of it? Here is one that you may not have thought about, but it is really, really important. As you get older, you tend to dehydrate. Young adults are comprised about 75% of water, whereas older adults are only about 50% of composed of water. So we tend to dehydrate with age, which can lead to dizziness, falls, and hip fractures and the like. It's associated with cardiovascular events and even loss of cognitive function. So a lack of water is kind of a real risk factor that most people don't really think about, but really can matter in terms of your overall health. We're advocating drink plenty of water. You can also eat, again, non-processed foods, which has a higher water content, as well as fruit juices if you don't like plain water or coffee and tea. But please don't drink sugar-added drinks or sports drinks, especially in older adults, because they don't add very much food value and they really, really don't possibly even help you in terms of hydration that much. What we're recommending is exactly what the National Institutes on Aging recommends, and that is for women over 50 years of age, drink about 3 quarts of water a day, which equates to about 9 cups of water and the rest from food, whereas men need a little bit.
That's it, folks. Tune in again for another round of Biotech Beat next Thursday.
Hello, I'm Dion Jones from Alpha, North Wales. You're listening to C.